welcome to Inside the Helix, a podcast presentation from DNA Genetics. Throughout this series, we focus on all things that matter to the pork industry. You'll hear from our award-winning team of geneticists, veterinarians, animal care providers, nutritionists, and other industry-leading experts. We'll explore pig production from genetic improvement all the way to meat quality. Listen along as we take a deep dive inside the DNA Helix.
In order to continually raise quality pork as efficiently as possible, a producer must always be striving for improvement. Today we're going to discuss a few strategies producers can consider as they work towards maximizing production, which are all related to gilt development. My guest today is Dr. Christine Manquist-Wiggum. Dr. Manquist-Wiggum is a veterinarian and director of health for DNA Genetics and Pillin Family Farms. Christine, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Curtis, for having me.
Now, Christine, I'm not sure if you listened to our last episode of this podcast, but to possibly refresh yours and our audience's memory, in our last episode, we visited with Brady McNeil, who described the importance of weighing gilts. This can be a tedious process, but can pay dividends in the reproductive health of a farm. Today, we're discussing gilt development, so these two topics really play nicely together. Let's kick things off. Why so much focus on the gilts? Can we really make big differences by making just a few small changes within our systems?
Yeah, absolutely. And in the big picture focus on the gilt is she's the future of our farm. If we can raise her correctly and we can follow good management practices as she's developing and starting to show signs of estrus and through the mating process and the feeding process, we can really set our farms up for success. So that's where gilt development and raising the gilt the right way has been a big focus for our team and even our research department.
So let's look at some different ways that we can impact gilt development in the GDU.
Yeah, so we've got quite a few different research areas as far as GDU production practices. And, you know, one that we'll talk about today really is setting up that barn for success in terms of stocking density and how stocking density impacts growth, development, estrus, and estrus detection.
Now, I understand that you recently were working on a study kind of related to stocking density. Why did you do the study, and really what were you hoping to learn or gain from this research?
It really started with experience that we had noticed some differences on our commercial side as we were making some changes to how we're developing the gilt. So in the past, we had run continuous flow on-site developers. In those situations, we tended to stock gilts a little too tightly. Maybe we had some disease issues that were occurring because we were continuous flow. And we really, you know, it wasn't the peak performance. We were seeing less than a 70% selection rate from birth to mating and said, okay, we need to look at this a little bit differently. So due to some health reasons and just some flow reasons, we'd actually decided to take all of our gilts offsite and raise them at offsite GDUs, so separate nursery and finishing phase. And when we compared closeouts and gilt attrition for our onsite developers versus this offsite development model, we noticed a stark difference, especially related to stocking density. And so when we look at the mortality specifically, we're over 2.5% better on wean to selection mortality with the offsite development with more space to those gilts in the finisher than we had with our onsite development. So that kind of sparked us down this track of, hey, maybe we should look at this a little bit differently, provide some, you know, economic values to offsite gilt development and really understand what this does from a estrus, onset of estrus, and estrus detection perspective as well.
Yeah, I'm definitely curious about those results. But before we get into the findings, talk through the methodology or the trial design. How did you collect your data?
Yeah, so the specific stocking density trial was a randomized control trial that we decided to do rather than rely on just field data, which are great for looking at trends, but we needed to really be able to measure this.
Right.
So we selected some of our research barns, got a group of same age gilts in, randomly assigned them to different treatment groups, and then followed them through from really wean to breed and track different production and growth and survivability parameters.
I'm curious too, Christine, it seems like you're able to capture quite a bit of data in this process. Could you provide some insight into your research team and maybe provide a little bit of background of how you collected that research and who helped collect that research information?
Yeah, so we're really lucky. We've got a great, robust production research team that consists of experts within our company, you know, in fields such as nutrition, genetics, health, statistical processes, reproductive physiology. And so really this was a joint effort to come together, use all those different disciplines to design a, you know, a really good trial for the summer. And part of that is incorporating some research interns. So this was, it was a great opportunity. We had a couple of students that spent the summer with us and were so instrumental in making this trial a success.
Now, are these interns, are they for the most part undergrads? Are they graduate students, a combination of everything?
Yeah, I mean, the Pillen DNA in general, we're open to any type of interns, but these specifically were grad student interns with research or, you know, postdoc type of focus. And so, you know, we do have these positions open every year, and we really look forward to getting to interact with students and work together on projects like this.
And not to go down the wrong path here, that's deviating from our subject today, but I imagine this is a great opportunity for them too, to not only, you know, expand upon some of their skills, but really get a hands-on feel for a production research system.
Absolutely. I mean, they were in the barns every day doing the hard work, getting the experience, and, you know, they've been able to take this research and present at major conferences and help share this data and information with other producers and other people.
Yeah, so let's get into that data and some of those observations or outcomes that may have developed from this study. What were your kind of your key findings or takeaways from some of this research?
Yeah, so first I'll give you a brief overview of the study setup. So we enrolled about a little over 850 individual gilts, all same age, and we assigned them to three different treatment groups at the end of the nursery. So they were approximately 11 weeks of age at the time we started the study. One of the treatments was stocking density of 7.6 square feet. The second was 10 square feet. And the third was 13.4 square feet. And those levels were taken so we could develop a pretty good curve and would be, you know, our tightest that we've stocked gilts at would be about that 7.6 or maybe a little less. And the loosest that we stocked gilts at would be that 13.4. So really wanted to have some variability in understanding what those different densities would do on the production parameters we were interested in.
So with your focus on stocking density, are you seeing that it impacted weight at all?
Yeah, so we have fairly robust findings on different growth rates. We would also have some mortality data. None of that was statistical, but there were some trends in terms of mortality and mortality reasons. But absolutely, biggest difference we saw was overall growth rate. And most of that was, you know, mid to late finishing growth rate. They were really pretty even towards the beginning of that finishing turn.
So then, Christine, how does stocking density impact age at first estrus or age at first mating?
Yeah, I mean, we're big proponents of what weight should a gilt be at the time of mating. So we talk a lot in terms of weight, which is why growth rate is so important, why we're looking at this in terms of stocking density. But, you know, we will start doing our heat detection or estrus detection around 20 weeks of age. So when we look at our week 24 weights, you know, we see about a 15-pound spread on the tightest to the loosest stocking. So that trend continues, obviously, as they get beyond. We did collect weights at 31 weeks, and we saw about a 40-pound difference. So then we also recorded weight at first cycle and age at first cycle. And as you would expect, those trends continued. You know, the weight at first cycle and weight at mating was significantly higher for the loosely stocked animals versus the tightly stocked animals. You know, we say they need to be at least 300 pounds at the time of mating. So having that increased growth rate, they're going to hit that 300 pounds sooner by the time they're on their second heat. We can mate them quicker, spend less money feeding them through the GDU phase, and have a more productive gilt moving forward.
Now, did stocking density have any impact on lesions or mortality of gilts, or I don't know, what about structure?
Yeah, so we did look at all of that, and we did see, you know, some more lesions on the tightly stocked animals. You know, by the time they get to that 30 weeks of age, it just got really tight in there, but nothing statistical in terms of lesions, lameness scoring, or mortality, other than the trends in mortality favoring the more loosely stocked animals.
Yeah. Now, you had a variety of individuals that were heat checking all summer long. Is there a good way to determine the accuracy of their heat checking process?
Yeah. I mean, this was kind of the nuts and bolts of the study and one of the real surprising findings. So I'd mentioned before we start heat checking at 20 weeks of age, and that 20 to 21 weeks, We really just did fence line contact. So we ran boars fence line, just kind of get everybody used to it. And then at 21 weeks of age, we started putting boars in pens. And we had a set protocol for how long, you know, each, the boars had to be in the pen and things. But you see the curves of the three different stocking densities in terms of heat check positive or heat check negative over time. Obviously, they increase, but there's a dramatic difference in the slope of the loosely stocked animals, so that 13.4 square feet, in between that 25 and 26 weeks of age. And consistently throughout the period, we had much higher percent cycling in the loosely stocked group versus the other two. And as you would expect, that 7.6 square foot, we saw fewer numbers of gilts cycling over time. So we look at the total percentage that we had our team members detecting a cycle by 31 weeks of age was around 60% in our 7.6 square foot group, around 68% in our 10 square foot group, and then over, you know, 73, 74% in that 13.4 square foot group. So that was using our people to do heat detection, but we really wanted to have a gold standard of, has she expressed estrus or not? So we used progesterone assay to act as that gold standard so we can look at accuracy measurements and look at, you know, what our false positive rate of heat detection and our false negative rate of heat detection is over time, you know, for each of those stocking densities.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess, again, this was all mostly at a finisher site, correct?
Yes. Yep.
So then how can this be applicable then to the commercial setting, the commercial environment?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people would do heat checking in the developer. Most developers are going to be a finisher setting. So at 20 weeks of age, an animal's not big enough to go into a stall or, you know, probably not going to go into a pen in a gestation barn. So this heat checking is going to occur in the finisher. So we tried to replicate the natural environment. And actually, the result findings that we saw on accuracy, false positivity rate, and false negative rates really reflected stocking density. So I'll share a little bit of those with you. You know, we looked at 24 weeks of age, 26 weeks of age, and 28 weeks of age across treatments. And the accuracy at 24 weeks of age was very similar across all three treatments. At that point, they're not that big. I think they were able to get in there and, like, still able to see animals individually. So the accuracy ranged from 83% to 86%. We did have a higher false positive rate. So false positive meaning our team called them heat check positive. The progesterone assay would have said that they had not expressed estrus yet.
Yeah.
So a higher rate of false positives actually in the loosely stocked group, that 13.4 square foot group, but definitely a lower false negative rate, only 3% in that loosely stocked group. The differences we start to pick up occur around 26 and 28 weeks of age, with the 28 weeks of age being the most astounding. So I'll just jump to that. In our 7.6 square foot group, our accuracy actually dropped down to 75% in that really tightly stocked group. In the 13.4 square foot group, our accuracy is still at that about, you know, 82%. So we're not losing accuracy as animals are getting older. And our false positivity rate has dropped. And the biggest difference is our false negative rate. So our false negative rate was only 13.5% in the 13.4 square foot group, meaning we missed 13.5 of all gilt cycling. But you compare that to the 7.6 square foot group, and we've missed 20% of the gilts that were cycling. So in terms of efficiency of gilt heat detection, by far, you know, the loosely stocked group outperformed 7.6 and 10 square foot.
Now, did any of this surprise you, or was this somewhat expected?
I think the trends were expected. The magnitude of the difference maybe wasn't quite as expected. You know, just especially with those accuracies and false positive and false negative rate, you know, I think we all would love to have a gilt stocked more loosely, but to really see how much we're missing by keeping them so tightly stocked. And honestly, the growth rate differences, you know, 40 pounds, that's a big deal. So just to have that data to measure, we can now go in and apply an economic model and understand what that space really does for us.
So then will you in the future then kind of continue to follow these guilds then throughout their reproductive lives?
Ideally we would. Unfortunately, we were not able to follow these guilds through to a commercial sow farm. But we do have, you know, several other sites where we've got fully pedigreed females. We can track this information on a population level and hone in on some of this data.
So then, Christine, where do you go from here? Or if you could elaborate or expand upon this research, what would be something to better understand or something that you would want to build from?
Yeah, I think ultimately, you know, being able to apply these concepts, put them into practice in our commercial setting, and follow that through to reproductive performance. If we can understand how these good practices impact farrowing performance, weaning performance, sow retention, sow longevity, and sow livability, then we can make big system impact and help our customers have big system impact.
So to summarize our conversation today, Dr. Manquist-Wiggum, here at DNA Genetics, our tagline is always focused on what matters. Why does this research matter to producers in a nutshell? What should they take from this that maybe could incorporate within their own system?
This research matters because the gilts are the future of our farms. We know that how we raise them impacts how they perform, how they cycle, and likely how they, you know, how long they stay in the herd and how well they do in the herd in the future. So, you know, we're committed to furthering this knowledge, sharing this knowledge, and want our team, our system, and our customers to be as productive as possible.
Very good information. Thank you very much, Dr. Christine Manquist-Wiggum, for joining us today on Inside the Helix. Until next time, I'm Curtis Harms.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Inside the Helix, presented by DNA Genetics. Inside the Helix is released every other Tuesday and is focused on what matters to the swine industry. To catch up on previous episodes, visit us online at dnaswinegenetics.com or find us at your favorite podcast streaming platforms. You can also keep up with DNA Genetics throughout the year by following us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. For Inside the Helix, I'm Curtis Harms.